You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The pride, passion, and pageantry of college football lives here. This is the Paul Feinbaum Show, Hour 3 Podcast.
Back, second half of the show. A lot happening in this next 2 hours, and we start with Jordan Reed, who helped the SEC Network yesterday for the NFL Pro Day coverage of Alabama, and we'll look ahead as we are 1 month from tonight for the NFL draft. Jordan, thank you for being here. Good afternoon. Great to have you on.
Absolutely, Paul. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's our pleasure as well. Let's talk about yesterday. You watched the entire Pro Day from Alabama. I know a couple of guys were unable to compete, but what stood out from what you saw?
Well, I think the biggest thing is just the big ticket item was Evan Neal, who was likely going to be the highest drafted player from Alabama this year. And, you know, it's a little bit of a down year for Alabama. They're not going to have as many first rounders as we have seen in years past. But next year, that definitely will be different with Bryce Young and Will Anderson, of course. But this year, they have Evan Neal, who I think definitely is going to be a first round pick. But after that, they have a bunch of day two and day three guys. Jalen Armour Davis, who is a really good player this past season at Alabama. Christian Harris is another one I thought that stood out as well. So the talent wasn't as deep as we have seen in years past, but Evan Neal definitely is going to keep the first-round streak intact for Nick Saban.
And I've seen him a couple of months ago at number one. It looks like he's dropped. What is the best guess for where he goes?
I still think he doesn't get outside of the top six with the Carolina Panthers. I think that's his floor right now, but his ceiling is probably the Houston Texans at three. I just think Aiden Hutchinson is going to be the number one overall pick right now based on what I'm hearing and then what the Jaguars have done this offseason and free agency and then some of the signings that they have made. So I think the Houston Texans at three is probably his ceiling with the Carolina Panthers at six being his floor.
So after him, let's talk about the SEC, because I know some Georgia players are going to move up. There's Arkansas. There are players across the board. So what would you see next from the conference?
Yeah, I mean, Georgia's loaded. I could talk about those guys, especially on the defensive side of the football, all day long. Everybody saw what Jordan Davis was able to do at the combine. I think he's probably going to end up being a top 15 to top 20 pick. It wouldn't surprise me if he goes even higher than that. And then there's plenty of other players, Nakobe Dean, Devontae Wyatt along the inside too, and the list goes on and on. Some of the players that they had on that defense, Quay Walker, Lewis Seen in the back end too, so they could have up to 9 or 10 guys drafted on that defense this year, which is just a phenomenal number considering the season that they had this past year.
Yeah, I know we've seen this a couple of times, 3 years ago with LSU. Alabama has been there a couple of times, but I mean, that's a staggering number. Put that into perspective for us lay people.
Yeah, I mean, it's really unheard of, especially just coming off of one unit. But the classes that Kirby Smart has been able to put together, it makes sense just because they've been able to stockpile talent. And I think this was the one team that was able to get over the hump of Alabama. And they were close. And that 1 year, I believe it was about five years ago now, where it was Tua Tagovailoa's freshman year, I believe it was, where he had the miraculous throw to Devontae Smith that really ignited that dynasty in a sense when they went on their run. But with that, I think Kirby Smart kind of used that as fuel a little bit, just trying to get over the hump. But he was able to do that, finally beating Alabama in a national title game.
Talking to Jordan Reed about the draft, we saw Jameson Williams there. We all know how painful that injury had to be in the recovery, but he seems like he's coming along. What happens to him because he hasn't been able to be part of the combine, be part of Pro Day? What happens on the other end when teams are looking at him?
I think he'll be fine. And the unfortunate thing for Jameson was that he was a very strong contender to be the first wide receiver off of the board. The New York Jets at number 10 overall, even the Atlanta Falcons at number 8 overall, I think he could have went that high. And that's not to say he still can't, but I think there's going to be some mixed opinions. Now, of course, you factor in the ACL, but we've seen ACL injuries are just like sprained ankles nowadays. Guys are getting over them very quickly, and just the treatment for those type of injuries are so easy nowadays for guys to come back from now. But I think he still has a chance to be the first wide receiver off of the board. There's just a lot more competition now that you have to factor in the injury.
On the other side, if you're a GM or an owner or a head coach and you know how great he is, you've seen him for a couple of years, you saw him at Ohio State, you really saw him this year at Alabama. How much do you have to dig deep into your soul to say, you know what, we're still going with him?
I mean, he's still a very talented player, honestly, Paul. And like I said, it would not be surprising if he ends up being the first wide receiver off of the board. There's still some teams that have valued him very highly despite the ACL injury. And like I said, the treatment, they're not worried about that. He'll probably be back the midway point of the NFL season. He said he has a 6 to 8 month recovery timeline, so that puts him right at about week 8 or week 9 for him to be fully back from it all. He's obviously going to start the season on the PUP, the physically unable to perform list, just because of the rehab and the recovery that he's going to experience. But just the dynamic that he brings to the table, there's no other wide receiver that's as complete a wide receiver as he does, as far as being able to attack all three levels of the field, and of course the vertical speed that he has and brings to the table as far as a field stretcher, and then just putting so much stress on defenses.
Jordan, I realize we're still a month away from the draft, but I couldn't help but think about this, and I'm sure you did as well yesterday, seeing Bryce Young at Pro Day, letting your mind wander a year ahead of us. And nobody knows what this year will look like, but just thinking about Bryce Young and Will Anderson, what would your best guess be without knowing who else is going to be available, but knowing that they will be next year?
Yeah, I think both of those guys are probably going to be strong contenders to be the number one overall pick. I would give Will Anderson the edge right now just because I think he was the best player in college football, bar none, last year, and that includes Bryce Young. I think Will Anderson should have finished second in the Heisman last year. I think he had that strong a season. So it wouldn't surprise me if both of those guys end up being, as far as in contention for the number one overall pick. And it's very fascinating that Alabama has never had a number one overall pick before, especially considering the talent that has entered that building before, and of course the talent that has exited out of it as well. So if I had to guess right now, I think there's three strong contenders for the number one overall pick in 2023, and of course this is a year out, so I think those two, and then also CJ Stroud from Ohio State, who also was another player that threw at the Buckeyes Pro Day as well.
Wow. Jordan Reed joining us from ESPN, many, many thanks, appreciate it. A month from tonight, the NFL draft from Las Vegas. We will take a break. More of your phone calls right after this.
Is your schedule too packed to see a doctor about your erectile dysfunction? Well, with Hims, now you can get treated for ED without stepping foot outside your door. They're changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. Hims provides access to doctor-trusted ED treatment options such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and entirely online. Just answer a series of questions and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option. If prescribed, your medication ships to you free. No insurance needed. So what are you waiting for? Join the hundreds of thousands of trusted Hims subscribers and get treated. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Paul. That's hims.com/Paul for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/Paul. Hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies on product and subscription plan. Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
Show. And Diane is up next in Alabama. Hello, Diane.
Is this Paul?
Yes.
Hey, Paul, it's Diane in Homewood, West Haven, Hoover.
Oh, yeah, I remember you.
I have not talked to you in a while. I was just going to say that I don't follow basketball very much because all my kids and, you know, Michael Nyswander is with Kiffin and at Ole Miss. But I want to say that I'm so proud of St. Petersburg, and I don't even follow that, but I learned a lot of lessons during
that.
You mean
St. Peter's, right?
Yes. What did I say? St. Petersburg?
Yes.
What did I say?
You said St. Petersburg.
Okay.
Which is a city in Russia.
No, what I meant was the team that almost made it to the eight.
St. Peter's.
Yes.
Jersey City, New Jersey.
Yes. And I'm so proud of them because all I do is root for Alabama. All my kids went there, and, you know, Michael is now with Kiffin over there and Ole Miss and stuff. I just wanted to say something. It's not too late to learn about basketball.
Well, you better hurry. The season's over Monday night.
I know.
Let's move along. Aslam is up next. Hello. Good afternoon to you.
Hey, Paul, I must give you compliments on the jacket and tie to borrow something from Cat Daddy. You're looking good today.
Thank you very much.
Paul, sometimes I know you try to stay apolitical with your format, but you had a previous caller whose inner inclination, if I can use that phrase, had to come out where he had to make a comment about a fourth black coach getting hired in the NFL.
Right.
And I just wanted to tell him to look up the word gerrymandering and find out how it is being applied today before he called your show to make a comment about a fourth black head coach in the NFL, which is, as you mentioned, which is 70% minority. So what's his brief? Grief.
Well, Aslam, I think you and I both know what his beef is, but no reason to say any more.
Okay, thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much. Yeah, appreciate it. Let's check out Jeff, who is in Ohio. Hello, Jeff.
What's going on, Paul?
Jeff, we are doing great. What about you?
Good. Hey, I heard that last guest you had on. Let me just get to the chase. Williams is going to go third behind his old Ohio State teammates, Olave and Garrett Wilson. That's a fact, Paul.
Okay. I'm good either way. It really doesn't matter.
Just come out and say it. What?
I said, I'm good either way.
Exactly. Hey, Paul, yesterday, I mean, the show started out. You had Jim call in. Everything was going good. He even got compliments from Augie and your publicist, John, in Louisville. And then Jim called in and kind of gave them props. And you're talking about having a caller fantasy camp with Jim heading that up. I mean, is the camp still on, or has that been deleted? Or what's going on with that?
Yeah, we're still working out the details. Now, it's up to Jim, because Jim has to agree to host it. I've already said he gets all the profits. I want nothing. I just want people to have the opportunity to learn from the very best.
Well, he is the best, and he better get your paralegal, who sounds like flunked out of med school first, to draw up a contract, because if I was signing up for it, I'd be afraid to put a deposit down, Paul, because the way you try to jerk Jim's chain every day like you did yesterday and most days, I'm afraid people will sign up and then Jim will quit the show again and quit the fantasy camp.
Now,
how are you going to handle
Jeff,
that?
Jeff, you're talking about the preeminent caller in the history of this show and acting like he can't handle himself without losing his cool, without quitting the show. I'm shocked.
Well, it's just, I mean, but how are people going to put a deposit down to be part of the fantasy camp? I hope you pull it off, and I wanted to be – I believe that would be incumbent on him
to deliver on his part of the deal.
Yeah, because I'm hoping maybe I could work with the wannabe Yankee new callers. You know what I'm saying? I could teach the Yankee new callers how to call in and bring some heat to the SEC.
Well, do you think we should have so we'll have one fantasy camp in Tuscaloosa? I mean, you're welcome. Do you want to? You could pick a really beautiful. You could pick a beautiful place like maybe Akron. You know, someplace in Ohio.
How about Lake Erie, Paul, in July?
And
we'll have it up on Lake Erie in July.
Yeah, well, we can do that. Ohio in July. I've been to Ohio in July. It's not bad.
Yeah, when are you gonna come up here and hook up with me?
Jeff, anytime. I'm about to start traveling again full time, so you just let me know where I need to go.
But I don't know why you're trying to get Jim to run this fantasy camp, then you run him off every day. I mean, people put deposits.
I can't
down.
Help it that he got upset yesterday and denied paternal involvement or paternity in this young man who claimed that he was his grandson. That's not my fault.
Well, I mean, that's a touchy subject. For anybody, come on, Paul.
Well, I would agree, but all he has to say is, he didn't have to give a Billy Graham sermon while he was telling it. He just had to say that's not my grandson.
Okay. Hey, these Texas A&M fans that were all upset about getting in the NIT, do they realize that their whole athletic department is basically NIT level? I mean, when has Texas A&M not had three losses in football? You know what I mean?
That would be 2020 when they only had one.
Okay, they didn't get in the playoffs, though.
No, they didn't.
So they're basically NIT level in both football and basketball, yet they come in here like they're big dogs going to take over the SEC. I mean, come on.
Okay, Jeff, thanks for the call. Legend is up next.
Woo! East Coast, baby. What's going on, Coach Feinbaum?
Dealing with the Yankees.
Man, if Jeff kissed Jim's ass any more than he already has, he's going to be known as an international ass kisser. That dude has to be getting 500 calls a day for Jim to tell him, talk about me, talk about me, talk about me, talk about me. Oh, my God, please. Hey, I got some advice for the new callers, Paul. Can I give it to them?
You may.
For all you 12-year-olds out there, y'all all get black hats for having the kahunas. Now ask your dad what that means. The kahunas to call in at that age. Most of all y'all know more than 95% of the morons that call this show about sports. And at the end of the day, that's what it's about. And I would encourage the young callers, when you get on the line, bring it. Attack that thing. Attack that call, baby. Grab it by the neck and attack that call like you on stage. And you got 30 seconds to say what you got to say. And that's for all callers. When you get on the line, have something friggin' to say. Don't stand there like an idiot like Paul's supposed to carry the conversation. Now for all the women that call. Keep calling. Man, I love you ladies. Let me tell you something. The greatest football minds I have ever met is beautiful Alabama women like Sheila Long, Heather Thomas, many of them that know twice as much football as these morons named Squirrel, I-Man, and Jim that never even talk about football. You rock, ladies. Keep on calling, baby. Keep on calling. Now for the rest of you callers, you morons that I beat down last week. Let me tell you something, Perry Mason. You just need to keep your legal mouth shut down there in New Orleans and chase them amulets. Now for Squirrel. Let me tell you something, Squirrel. I played football, brother, in high school. I'm sorry, Paul, did you play college ball?
I think he did, but I'm not sure.
No, I'm talking about you. Did you play college ball?
Did I play?
Yes.
No.
No, but you know about sports, don't you? I played high school ball. I might have got kicked off the team in the first week, but I played a game. I know more about sports than all you morons. That's why I'm the legend. I went to the Baltimore Bullets game at the age of six and said, Big E, Wes Unseld, and Earl Monroe fell in love with basketball. Seen my first football game with Johnny Unitas, Raymond Berry, and Bubba Smith, and fell in love with football. I've been following it 50 years. You ask Squirrel if I ever put on a helmet? Let me tell you something, Chump. I had a helmet on last night when I was with your wife. Black hat. East Coast, baby. I'm out.
We are coming right back with much, much more.
This podcast is proud to be supported by Jet's Pizza, the number one pick in Detroit-style pizza. Why? It's simple. Jet's is better. With the thickest, crispiest, cheesiest Detroit-style pizza in the country, there's no competition. Right now, get $5 off any 8-corner pizza with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Go to jetspizza.com to learn more and find a location near you. Again, try Jet's signature 8-corner pizza and get $5 off with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Jet's Pizza. Better because it has to be.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
And we are back. And I know a lot of you occasionally will see this date in history and what happened on this date. And I saw something yesterday which really caught my attention. It was this date in history 41 years ago. It was the day of the national championship game between Bob Knight's Indiana Hoosiers and Dean Smith's North Carolina Tar Heels. It was the night of the Oscars, which have been in the news lately. And then something happened that afternoon in Washington that changed everything. And as I was looking at the newspaper, I noticed the name of the on the lead story of the New York Times, who was covering the White House at the time. And I knew that from the past, but I never put it all together. And so I contacted our good friend Hal Raines, the former executive editor of the New York Times, a former Pulitzer Prize winner, and asked him about that. And Hal, good afternoon. It's so great to have you back.
Thanks, Paul. It's great to be back, and it's a somber memory that you brought to mind. To be perfectly candid, it had not occurred to me we were on that anniversary till you emailed me.
And we're talking about predates a lot of people watching and listening, but it was an assassination attempt on President Reagan right after he made a speech. Hal, you were still a relatively young reporter 41 years ago. We all were.
We were. You know, Paul, it struck me when you reminded me it's 41 years ago, and on that day it was only 16 years from when I wrote my first story at the Alabama-Auburn game at our alma mater, the Birmingham Post-Herald, in 1964, till I was writing the lead story in the New York Times about President Reagan's near-fatal attack. And it's a day, of course, I'll never forget. And thank goodness it turned out that it was not fatal.
And how, not to give a lecture on how everything has changed, that's self-evident, but, you know, we barely had cable television. We did not have any of the things that we have today. So what was it like once you and everyone else became aware of what was going on?
Yeah, you know, Paul, it's almost like we were at a transition point in technology. And it was also that era when a president could go into what might be thought of as politically hostile territory and be received politely. So Reagan went to address the AFL-CIO annual meeting at the Washington Hill Hotel. It was a morning meeting, not the afternoon. And he got what I described as a muted reception, but there was no ugliness at all, and no, he didn't try to insult his audience, and they received him graciously. As happened in those days, only the reporters in the pool went with the president as he exited the hotel through a side entrance. I and a couple of colleagues walked out to the front of the hotel, and I was hailing a cab when I looked down the side at T Street on the side of the hotel and saw unusual activity. I think maybe I saw a cop car or something, and I said, that's not right. I walked down there and discovered the motorcade had left, of course, taking the president to the hospital. But I discovered he had been shot. And here's another that was before cell phones. I had to race back down to K Street to our office and arrive breathlessly. And somewhat to my surprise, since I was a relatively new reporter on the Times, I was told I was writing the lead story because I was covering the president that day and he got shot on my watch. And a number of miraculous things happened, and most people don't realize how nearly fatal that attack was. And I'll tell you an interesting story about that. The White House, and I wrote in the first day story that said he was in good, stable condition, and put a very cheerful spin on it. The medical reporter at the New York Times at that time was Lawrence K. Altman, who was a medical doctor,
right,
who preferred writing about medicine rather than practicing it. We asked him to come down the next day. He interviewed the doctors, and he was able to write based on the procedures that they had used, and they described to him, technically, doctor to doctor, he broke the news that the president's life was actually under severe threat. And he was saved because Agent Jerry Parr diverted the motorcade from the White House to George Washington Hospital because he sensed the president was having labored breathing and he was complaining of pain in his side. Well, it was a 22 bullet that had hit his rib. Luckily, and that's what the pain was from. Luckily, that deformed the bullet enough that it didn't kill, damage a vital organ like the heart or some of the other vital organs. But it was a very serious episode, and the rest of the day was a blur to me. People who many people have seen the old-fashioned newspaper newsrooms where you had rows of desks. I went to my desk, and I swept everything off of it, calendars, notebooks, because I knew that under our time system, I would be getting a flow of paper memos from other reporters, the guy who covered the Secret Service, the guy who covered the Congress. And it's the kind of story that we were trained to write at the Times, where it was not just the event, but you had to have historical perspective, you had to have the political analysis, you had to have the effect on foreign affairs, you had to have what the congressional leaders were saying. So it's a very comprehensive format. And frankly, I was not a great deadline reporter when I went to the Times after having been a successful, but I was mainly doing in-depth stuff where you had several days. And when I was hired by the Times in 1978, I quickly observed that if you wanted to have a major beat, you had to get very good under deadline. And I basically educated myself to do that and was able to rise to that occasion, I hope. And your email saying you had reread the story made me feel very good. And it was 6 months before I realized that my desk calendar was on the floor beside my desk.
I cannot relate to it because I got the audience has heard me tell the story enough times. When Coach Bryant died the next year, and what I went through that day. But I want you to tell. This is not the age of your. Of your Apple PowerBook laptop, how did you write this important story, which I'm sure you later became the editor? We're going to talk about this another time, but for those who don't know, how had just become the editor of the New York Times on 9/11, and that's a whole nother day that I want to talk to you about. So so in New York, and they are, I'm sure, breathing down your neck right now.
Yeah. Well, it was, as I say, we didn't have cell phones, so I had to take a taxi back and go into the bureau, immediately plunge into the story. And interestingly, Paul, computers had not arrived with full force. Well, there was only one computer keyboard in the bureau that was linked to the mainframe computer in New York. The rest of the 50 reporters there, we were writing on typewriters, just as we did at the Birmingham Post-Herald in
64. Although this was an IBM Selectric, and it was faster than our old Underwoods, the old Model A's we used at the late lamented Post-Herald. But in any event, I wrote that story one page at a time, pulled the copy out of the typewriter bale, called to a clerk, copy. This young person carried it into another room where the guy with the link to the computer in New York would retype the words I had just written into the computer. And so it was like Stone Age technology compared to what exists today. And I've often reflected on the irony that I wrote that story basically the way newspaper men and women had been writing stories in the newsroom in a chaotic condition, one page at a time on a typewriter.
When you finished it, what happened next? I mean, you're it never ends. I mean, this is a story that went on, still going on in many respects. But
yeah,
what did you sound like you just go, okay, I'm going home now. I mean, at this point, you don't know whether the president's going to live or die. And by the way, the early reports were that the press secretary, James Brady, had died. And so it was no small matter what was going on here.
Yeah, I knew Jim very well. And I had to write the first report that night that Lynn Nofziger, the political director of the White House, who I knew very well, told me that he thought Jim had permanent brain damage even after it was confirmed that he was alive. So we never wrote in the paper that he was dead. That may have gotten out on the wires or on the broadcast, but I had to unfortunately write that my friend, who I knew very well, is a professional colleague. I mean, we weren't chumps, but we knew each other well from being on the campaign plane together, and I had to write that he probably had serious permanent brain damage because the doctor briefing said it was in the part of the brain that affects personality. And Jim was just a hail fellow, well met, a joker, and he always greeted me as Whiskey Man.
Good reason for that.
Because he had read the novel that I published in 1977 called Whiskey Man. And when he reemerged after months of physical therapy, and there was an event in Washington that I attended. He was in a wheelchair, and his speech was somewhat affected, but the first words he said to me were, "Hey, Whiskey Man." So I knew that somewhere in there, the old Jim Brady was still with us. But it was a tragic result. Jim had to go through excruciating physical therapy. And the other thing he told me that time, he said, you shouldn't call them physical therapists. You should call them physical terrorists.
We're talking to Hal Raines about this day. And Hal, I had never read this, of course. So I read the sports column by one of my favorite people, Dave Anderson, who was another Pulitzer Prize winner. And
yeah.
The Oscars that day, it's amazing the fact that the Oscars and the NCAA championship would be on the same day, but that happened during the 80s. The Oscars were canceled until the next day. But the NCAA decided to have its championship, and Dave Anderson, I don't know if you've ever read this because you were probably too busy, he excoriated NBC for doing it for the money. And it's hard to imagine today that the president of the United States would nearly be fatally shot.
Right.
I'm sure you would have edited the fatally out of that. And the NCAA tournament went ahead and had the championship game.
So that was NBC?
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's not surprising. So, one, Dave, like all columnists at times, had complete freedom about what he said, and he was a very thoughtful guy. And not to beat up on NBC, but look how they handle the Olympics now.
Well, true.
we're the only country in the world that can't watch the Olympics in real time. And they're doing it for the same reason they put that game on, is for the money.
Well, it's just, I don't know. These are things that, and I think of you, and I feel like I'm abusing you sometimes with these questions, but it's such an important moment in history, just not only for what happened, which has been documented many, many times, but just the intricacies of how different the world was from a technological standpoint. I know you've had
it
many.
It was different in political atmosphere, too. You
exactly.
know, Reagan was a remarkable character, and one of the things I wrote in that story was the wisecracks he made going into the hospital, including telling the surgeons, "I hope you're all Republicans."
Oh, that is funny. Yeah, I do remember that now. You mentioned George Washington University, which wasn't far. Had they not done that? Had they? Because nobody was really sure what had happened. Would Reagan have died? Had they not immediately gone to the hospital?
I think he would have been saved, but I think that lung would have filled up with blood. It collapsed, as I recall, and time was of the essence. And somewhat miraculously, Reagan walked into the emergency room under his own power.
Oh, I didn't realize
then
that.
Then collapsed, and that's when the medical staff realized, you know, the seriousness. But they didn't even know he was shot. They had to undress him to find the entry wound.
And of course, the day is best remembered, Hal, I'm sure, for not only that, but for Al Haig taking control of the press room, the Secretary of State saying, "I am in charge here."
Yeah, and Cap Weinberger and Haig got in a fight at the about who was in charge at the White House, and Jim Baker, the very diplomatic chief of staff, told me later that, or he had to come out and say, "Oh no, there was no disturbance at the White House," which of course was not true. Two hot-headed cabinet members, both brilliant men, strong-willed. Let me tell you another footnote to history that Jim Baker, the
sure.
chief of staff then, later Secretary of State, told me two things. One, that Jerry Parr, the agent who's credited with saving Reagan's life, remained an honored member of the Secret Service and had heroic status. But Jim Baker told me that he was so traumatized by that event that he became extremely nervous about exposing the president, and that they actually had to get other, you know, other people in the Secret Service to help bring him along to letting the president go out in public again. That's how traumatic it was for everyone. And the other thing that Secretary Baker told me some years later was he felt the president was never the same physically after he was shot. That's not to say he didn't recover. In fact, he started doing workouts to build up his chest muscles where he was injured, and actually had to have his suits altered because he gained muscle mass, which was unusual in someone over 70 years old. But that said, you remember, like in the early days of the presidency, the first 2 months, he would go out horseback riding often, and that sort of activity diminished gradually.
Hal Raines, just an incredible look back in history on this day, 41 years ago, with the president being shot on the eve of the national championship in basketball. Hal, come back. We have 18,000 other things to ask you about in history, and we would love to talk to you again soon.
Okay, be in touch, Paul.
Hal Raines, just an incredible conversation. At some point, I do want to talk to him about 9/11, because being the editor of the New York Times on the most horrifying day in that city's history had to be another event that is worth discussing. We are heading to a break right now. We appreciate you being here. We're coming right back.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sportsbook bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
You back. Trey is up next in Arkansas. Good afternoon, Trey.
Howdy, Paul.
Howdy.
I wanted to talk to you about that Jaden Hazelwood. that Arkansas signed, the number one receiver out of the transfer portal?
Right.
And also, what do you think about our recruiting class?
Well, I think recruiting, Trey, has been phenomenal, and I think there's a reason for it. Things are just everything is looking up in Fayetteville. Thank you very, very much. Let's check in with Wyatt up next in Florida. Hello, Wyatt.
Hey, man, how's it going?
Very well. Thank you.
So I am a diehard dog in the heart of Gainesville, Florida. And I was wondering if you, what your opinion on Georgia's next season is going to be.
I think it's going to be a challenge to repeat what's happened now. I don't believe that it will be a bad season, but I think Georgia right now is going to be the favorite to get to Atlanta. But I see the hill to be way too steep at the moment. We're in late March to overcome Alabama. I just think the defense is just going to have – it's going to go through one of the major transformations in college football history in terms of what it has lost. Thank you for the call. We appreciate it. We still have an hour to go. We'll head up to Minneapolis in this hour to check in on tomorrow's Final Four for the women and more of your phone calls right after this.